This is class number 14 in the Econ 111 Economics course. This is the final class lecture of the course. Your assignments for Chapter 20 and extra credit work associated with it are due today. In this class, we continue going over miscellaneous topics that may be covered on the AP Economics exams, but have not been covered much in previous classes. We will especially focus today upon topics in microeconomics. In previous classes, we have explored ways in which governments can intervene in otherwise free market economies. One way that governments have sometimes intervened is by setting price ceilings or price floors in particular markets for goods and services. Exhibit 34 illustrates price floors and price ceilings. A price floor is a government-mandated price above the market free market equilibrium price. In the example at Exhibit 34, suppose the free market equilibrium price of a gallon of milk were $6 per gallon, but the government intervened and said the price per gallon of a milk were a minimum of $8 per gallon. At the price floor in this example, what would be the quantity supplied and what would be the quantity demanded? This price floor would result in a surplus of quantity supplied over quantity demanded. What would the government do about this surplus? Sometimes they destroy a product, or sometimes they give it away at a subsidized price to foreign nations. When one has a price floor situation, the quantity supplied is greater than the quantity demanded, which means since more is supplied than more is demanded, something has to be done with this excess. Now, in another example at Exhibit 34, suppose the free market equilibrium price of a standard apartment rental unit were $6,000 per year. But the government intervened and said the price per standard rental unit were a maximum of $4,000 per unit. This is called rent control, and various city governments over history have imposed such rent controls because many people complained about high rent prices. At the price ceiling in this example, what would be the quantity supplied and what would be the quantity demanded? This price ceiling would result in a shortage of quantity supplied under quantity demanded. The end result of such a scheme is that some people get apartments at very low prices, while others are literally left out in the cold. Sometimes these people have to find another community in which to live, making their commute to work longer, or some other means. Sometimes governments will ration available apartment units to their political favorites. As you perhaps can tell, it seems to me that such price ceilings and price floors are ill-conceived ideas. One common form of a price floor are minimum wage laws. Such laws set a floor on wages paid. So anyone whose economic productivity is not greater than the floor will not be employed, thus tending to increase the unemployment rate, especially as the minimum wage is set at a higher and higher level. So again, just to recap with respect to these price floors and price ceilings, they result in either shortages or surpluses in quantity supplied in relation to quantity demanded. In previous classes, we already considered the issue of elasticity. We looked at price elasticity of a demand, income elasticity of demand, and cross-price elasticity of a demand. One we did not mention is price elasticity of supply. It is simply the percentage change in quantity supplied divided by the percentage change in price. A good in which there was a large percentage increase in quantity supplied with a very modest percentage increase in price would be said to have a high price elasticity of supply. A 10% increase in quantity supplied with a 10% increase in price would be said to have a unit price elasticity of supply. Whereas a 5% increase in quantity supplied with a 10% increase in price would be said to have a more inelastic price elasticity of supply. Economists have tried to analyze the economics of consumer choice. Economists use the term utility to describe the satisfaction that a consumer receives in consuming a given product. Economists typically measure utility in dollars on the premise that people will be willing to pay for something up to the level of their satisfaction. If I would be willing to pay $100 for an old shoe, then $100 must be the level of satisfaction or utility I derive from it. Marginal utility is the satisfaction gotten from the last unit purchased and consumed of a given product. For most material products, people obtain diminishing levels of utility for additional quantities of a given product. In theory, the utility maximizing rule is that the marginal utility divided by price of each product should be the same across the spectrum of products purchased. In the study of consumer choice, there is a term you will read about called consumer surplus. Consumer surplus is the difference between the utility gained from all of a certain product purchase versus the market price paid for them. The utility of all the units purchased of the product is typically higher than the market price paid, hence the surplus. Once my marginal utility in purchasing an additional unit of some product is less than its unit market price, then I stop buying the product. Let's now consider the issue of price discrimination. In order to maximize profits, firms would like to be able to engage in price discrimination. Price discrimination is the charging of different customers with different prices for the same product. Since different customers have different utility levels for a given product, a firm could make more profit if it charged different customers at different prices. The customer that was willing to buy the product for $100 would be charged $100, while the customer that was willing to buy the product for $1,000 would be charged $1,000. Such price discrimination is difficult for a firm to implement because of such factors as the difficulty to separate and identify customers in different utilization categories, and also the fact that there are product resales, sometimes called secondary markets. So if one customer is able to buy a product at substantially lower price than another customer, well, then that customer might then resell it to the customer, and that would tend to bring prices all down to the same level because of these secondary markets. For example, in the example just mentioned about someone who would be willing to pay $100 for a given product versus the person who would be willing to pay $1,000, well, the person who, let's say the vendor was able to sell the first person the product for $100, when the second person came around and found out he would be charged $1,000, probably he would not like that from the vendor if he realized another person were charged $100, And this person might go to the person who was only charged $100 and be able to purchase the product from him for maybe $110. So because of the resale issue and other factors, price discrimination is a very difficult thing to implement in a free market economy. Efficiency is another term economists often use. Economists try to identify how a certain economy can be most efficient. They use a term called Pareto efficiency to describe the optimal point for a society when any further improvement for some comes at the expense of others. Pareto here is spelled P-A-R-E-T-O. The term technological efficiency measures the output per dollar of input expenditure. Any improvement in this ratio of output to input will allow us to make more efficient use of resources. The term allocative efficiency involves the channeling of resources to their most productive and desired uses. Now, in previous classes, we considered the topic of production and cost. Total physical product, also sometimes called total product, is the output of a firm and the product it produces. Average physical product, also called sometimes called simply average product, is total physical product divided by the units of input. For example, suppose a firm is a dressmaker. With 10 employees, the firm can make 100 dresses. So the average physical product is 10. It's calculated by taking the 100 dresses and divided by the 10 employees to come up with an average physical product of 10. If the firm hired one additional employee, let's say it could make 120 dresses. So the marginal physical product in this example, and sometimes it's called simply the marginal product, would be 20. And that would be calculated by taking the 120 dresses minus the 100 dresses to come up with the 20 dresses that the 11th employee could produce. By adding one more employee that the firm could produce, I should say. Recall to our discussion about total cost, fixed cost, and variable cost. Remember also that we mentioned how economists differentiate accounting costs from economic cost, whereas accounting costs consider only the actual dollars produced to produce something. Economic cost also consider the opportunity cost. For example, let's say I am a shoemaker and spending 2 hours making a pair of shoes with materials costing $10. The accounting cost would simply be the $10 in material cost. But the economic cost would add to the materials cost the amount I as a shoemaker could make having worked 2 hours for another employer. Now let's say I could make $8 per hour with another employer or $16 for the 2 hours. So the economic cost of making the pair of shoes is $10 in material cost plus $16 in opportunity cost for a total economic cost of $26. And again, economists typically measure cost and profits in terms of economic cost and economic profits, which take into account opportunity cost. During this economic course, we looked at four different product markets: perfect competition, monopolistic competition, oligopoly, and monopoly. Exhibit 35 through 38 explore firms in each of these product markets and how they maximize profits. Exhibit 35 shows the case in an industry with perfect competition. In this type industry, we have to differentiate the supply and demand curves for the industry overall versus for a particular firm in the industry. The top graph shows an example for the industry overall, and the bottom graph shows it for a firm in the industry. Notice in the top graph that the equilibrium price is $6 per unit. That means that for a firm in this perfectly competitive industry, that the demand price is always $6, no matter how many units the firm produces, as can be seen in the bottom graph. According to the bottom graph, the marginal cost equals the marginal revenue when the firm has produced 3 units. 3 units is the profit-maximizing output for the firm. At that price, the average total cost equals average revenue, so economic profits are zero. Zero economic profits is the long-run equilibrium situation in a perfectly competitive industry. Exhibit 36 shows the case in a monopolistic industry. Certain questions are asked in this exhibit. Take time to try to answer these questions, and I shall return to them later in the class to give you the answers. Exhibit 37 shows the case for a firm in an industry characterized by monopolistic competition. Certain questions are asked in this exhibit. Take time to try to answer these questions, and I shall return to them later in the class. Exhibit 38 shows the case for a firm in an industry characterized by oligopoly. An oligopolist has a very unusual kinked demand curve. Economists have argued this is the case because oligopolists find it very difficult to raise prices without losing much market share. But they do not pick up much market share by lowering prices because their competitor readily lowers their price as well. Certain questions are asked concerning the oligopolist graph in this exhibit. Take time to try to answer these questions, and I shall return to them later in the class. An oligopolist faces a situation where it faces one other competitive rival in the industry. Given such a situation, mathematical game theory can help us to know what is the profit-maximizing strategy for an oligopolist. In game theory, a payoff matrix helps to show the alternatives faced by each competitor. At the bottom of Exhibit 38, you can see 2 payoff matrices. The dominant strategy for a particular firm is the strategy which yields the highest profitability, no matter which strategy the firm's competitor responds with. Certain questions are asked concerning the oligopolist payoff matrices found in this exhibit. Take time to try to answer these questions, and I shall return to them later in the class. Okay. Now let's go back and try to answer the questions posed in the exhibits. Exhibit 36 shows the case in a monopolistic industry. Profit is maximized at that output level where marginal cost comes to equal marginal revenue. Notice the marginal revenue curve lies below the monopolist demand curve, which is why the demand curve is continuously downward sloping. Marginal cost comes to equal marginal revenue in this case at 2,000 units of output, where the cost is around $7 per unit. At 2,000 units of output, the demand curve indicates the market price is $8 per unit. So the monopolistic firm enjoys economic profits of $1 per unit. Remember that in a perfectly competitive industry, in contrast, in the long run, perfectly competitive firms enjoy zero economic profits. In the example of Exhibit 36, zero economic profits occur at an output level of 3,000 units and at a unit price of $6 per unit. So 1,000 less units are produced because a monopolist will pursue a strategy to maximize its profits, that is different from the situation that firms face in a perfectly competitive industry. Economists speak of a term called deadweight loss to describe the economic loss to society resulting from monopoly instead of perfect competition. Exhibit 37 shows the case for a firm in an industry characterized by monopolistic competition. Its graph looks a lot like the graph for a monopolist, but with one very important difference. At its profit-maximizing output, its product sales price equals its average cost, which means the firm enjoys zero economic profit. Normally, in the long run, firms in an industry characterized by monopolistic competition enjoy zero economic profit. Otherwise, competitors flock in and take away customers. In the example of Exhibit 37, the firm maximizes its profit where marginal cost equals marginal revenue, or 2,000 units of output. In contrast, if this were a perfectly competitive industry, the firm would maximize its profit at an output of 3,000 units. Exhibit 38 shows the case for a firm in an industry characterized by oligopoly. In the example at Exhibit 38, the firm maximizes its profit where marginal cost equals marginal revenue or 3,000 units of output. Looking now at the payoff matrices for the two oligopolists in Exhibit 38, in Scenario 1, the dominant strategy for oligopolist number 1 is Strategy 2, and the dominant strategy for oligopolist number 2 is Strategy 2. In both of these cases, Strategy 2 yields a better result than Strategy 1. Taking, for example, in Scenario 1 for oligopolist number 1, if oligopolist number 1 pursues Strategy 1, then, and let's say that oligopolist number 2 pursued strategy 1, oligopolist number 1's profit would have been $210. Now, this is less than, in that scenario, than if it had pursued strategy number 2, which would have yielded oligopolist number 1 a profit of $300. In addition, if oligopolist number 2 had pursued strategy number 2, yet oligopolist number 1 had pursued strategy number 1, oligopolist number 1 would have had 120 profit at using strategy 1 versus 240 in level of profit if it had pursued strategy 2. So in both of these cases, does not matter whether oligopolist number 2 had pursued strategy 1 and 2, or 2, oligopolist number 1 is better off pursuing strategy number 2. Now in scenario 2 at Exhibit 38, the dominant strategy for oligopolist number 1 is strategy 2, and the dominant strategy for oligopolist number 2 is strategy 1. I should mention here that a scenario is possible in which there is no dominant strategy because both strategies have a pro and con result dependent upon how the competitor responds. In other words, there is another scenario which one could conceive where neither a strategy 1 nor a strategy 2 was the dominant strategy. But again, in these cases presented in Exhibit 38, there is a dominant strategy for both oligopolist number 1 and oligopolist number 2. One final topic we should mention are resource markets. Resources include the factors of production like land, labor, and capital. Such resource markets experience what is called derived demand. Derived demand is the demand for a resource such as labor, which is derived from the product that the resource helps to produce. Exhibit 39 shows some definitions and formulae you should become familiar with associated with resource markets. This now concludes this Econ 111 economics course. We have seen how there are many truths that even humanistic-based economics has been able to discover and systematize. Yet, we have also seen in this course how humanistic-based economics is deeply flawed. Because of its unwillingness to be based upon the foundation of God's Word, humanistic-based economics is ultimately unable to advise a course that will lead to long-term economic prosperity. There simply can be no long-term prosperity of any kind so long as man resides under God's wrath. And we have seen how humanistic-based economics is unable adequately to consider the moral and spiritual dimensions of economics. It is necessary to build an economic philosophy upon God's Word if we are to be true to reality and if we are going to be able to recommend a wise course of economic policy. Hopefully, this course has helped you to see the contours of such an endeavor.